Jill Meredith Wolfe, 34, January 18th, 2014, Chicago Cultural Center. My relationship is former coworker and friend.
Lindy Suzanne Clapp, age 37, today's date, January 18th, 2014, location Chicago Cultural Center, relationship to partner is former coworker and friend.
Hey, Lindy. I'm really curious about some of the highlights that you would see from your past 30 plus years.
I guess the highlights for me would probably be some of my achievements. Along the way, I had a really good experience growing up. I was valedictorian of my high school. I graduated from college summa cum laude, studied abroad for a year, and got a lot of good life experience in prior to going to medical school, which I graduated from in 2004. And I started a medical residency after that. And since that time, I've had a lot of experiences that brought me to this place that I'm at today.
So I'll make sure to refer to you as Dr. Lindy then from here on out.
You Doc. Can, but, you know, that's not really how I see myself. That's a part of me and a part of my past and my education. And for sure, I'll carry with me throughout life. But Lindy is fine.
Okay. Dr. Lindy. I'll just say Lindy for now on. Tell me about any relationship or knowledge that you have about hepatitis C, maybe what you learned in medical school or anything really.
Well, in medical school, you learn that hepatitis is a virus of the liver. There are a number of different types of hepatitis. The main three that we deal with in this country are A, B, and C. And hepatitis C is a chronic disease. In medical school, I think I got from it that it was really similar to HIV in terms of its the way it's transmitted. And just it was kind of grouped in with that disease a whole lot. So my understanding of it was mostly that IV drug abusers got it, and people who weren't careful about protecting themselves from sexually transmitted diseases. And I really just didn't see – it wasn't something that I felt like I would be personally affected by. It was just something that – patients had, and that, you know, I had to memorize the treatments for and answer on a test. So that's basically what I had.
I'm just curious with the memorizing of what the treatments, what do you remember about the treatments in terms of the memory?
That there was like a triple whammy treatment that was kind of hellish to go through for 6 months or so, and that some people cleared the virus after it, some didn't. I knew that some people didn't always have the disease chronically, even without treatment, but I didn't know anything about percentages, and I didn't know a whole lot about it.
It was Hep C kind of HCV, just something that you learned about is like another, you know, important thing in med school, or was it something that you were starting to see in your work as a doctor and in your life?
Well, because I only went through medical school and actually completed an internship, I was still really after that internship, I focused more specially in one particular area of medicine that had nothing to do with Hep C. So I saw it in patients, but it was mostly only patients who were at the end stage of the disease, so chronically ill, and they had so many other things going on. That Hep C was just another thing to learn, really. It was just another disease.
More end-of-life stuff than being able to prevent anything from... And so tell me about that wasn't the specialty you went into. What was the specialty you went into?
Anesthesia was the one I chose, and so I did a general internship that had a lot of surgery, and surgery internships focus on end-of-life a lot because you're doing a lot of critical care, and that's why Hep C, I was seeing the kind of end stage and no prevention. But and then anesthesia, I really only did that for close to a year before I decided to leave the medical profession for a period of time.
Do you want to tell us about that?
I can do. It's a big part of my story. In my first year of residency training, I actually developed some problems with addiction, and due to my issues with that, I chose to leave the medical residency and pursue other things at that time.
So was your addiction, during your anesthesiology rotation, was that the first time that your addiction had popped up?
Yes, completely. I really had had a really fun life up to that point, and to me, my partying hadn't overwhelmed any of my academic efforts, and I looked, for all practical purposes, like somebody who just liked to go out
and drink.
And then I got into residency, and I just wasn't able to have the fun social life that I did prior to getting into residency. And due to a number of other things, started to get kind of depressed, and the drugs that I was supposed to be throwing away in that residency, I wound up experimenting with, and that's a terrible idea because they're highly addictive. And very soon after doing that, I wound up basically backing out of the residency because I knew that that was just not the right thing to be doing, and it was a terrible thing for me to continue. And that was the beginning of kind of a long unraveling of a lot of the things that I'd built up. But really got me to a point now that I feel like I'm where I'm supposed to be.
And so, you know, alcohol is a drug that is legal for us, that we can, majority of us of age and even underage, can access. The medications and the drugs that you were using in your rotation and anesthesiology obviously isn't necessarily readily accessible to the large majority of individuals. So, I mean, alcohol was something that's it's normal to in our culture, it's legal. But was this part of sort of your having fun and part of what maybe became part of the problem as well?
Entirely, really. The drugs and the anesthesia part of my story were a small blip of my use of substances to try to help me get through difficult situations. But once I left the residency, I didn't do those drugs anymore, really. I didn't have access to them. I didn't even really want to, but I wanted something to help me kind of get through all of the difficult situations that I was still having. Obviously, that was a big interruption in my life, and I chose to cope with it with substances still. And alcohol was the most readily available, like you just said, and it quickly became a problem for me that I wasn't really ready to see for a number of years until things started to go bad, and they went from bad to worse, and I developed more or less issues with alcohol the same as I had had that small period of time of addiction to the drug. So, yeah, addiction and alcoholism basically have caused a huge interruption in my life and also brought about incredible transformation.
And, I mean, you're sitting here in front of me. Alcohol is not a part of your life today. Hindsight's 20/20. My question for you is, you know, with alcohol and it being hindsight 2020, what were you trying to cover up? I mean, what was it, what was it helping you do or covering?
Yeah, well, I wanted to be the perfect kid since I can remember for my parents. I was raised almost like with an idyllic existence coming up, and my brother and sister and I all just really wanted to please our parents. And so I did that in school and academically, but I recognized in my early 20s that my sexuality was probably not in line with the ideals that I'd been taught, and that that was an imperfect part about me. So I started early on to try to kind of, or I built these two different lives. And well, I more or less was pursuing what occurred to me naturally in terms of my interest in women, as as more than just friends. But then I wanted to appear as just this perfect or what is perceived as normal, like student and daughter for my parents. And that's when it started. And then, there was just a kind of a heavy party atmosphere in college and in medical school is really where I experimented with drugs and partied. And it came to be that by the time I got to into medical school, that I was showing up as a medical student who didn't really like medical school and was struggling through that. And then I was showing up as a like party hard kind of young, upwardly mobile lesbian in Memphis, Tennessee was where I was at in medical school. And then showing up for my parents as this, perfect daughter who doesn't have boy problems and, you know, just could fit into the small community in East Tennessee that I grew up in. So, I'm growing in all these different directions and kind of making a different personality for each part. And there was not much space for me to fit in all that. And so the way that I found to unwind was either out with people, I could relax with a drink, or if I was uncomfortable around the people, I could kind of like just back up and drink and just disappear. And I didn't, you know, I could rely on the kind of social lubrication that the drinking gave me to make me appear any way I needed to in each crowd. And it wasn't a problem because I didn't have to rely on it in all situations then. Kind of, I think when everything became ultimately the problem was when I got thrown into that residency and I didn't have the social environment I had. I was far from my family. I just had me and like this crazy work schedule. And the only thing I had was alcohol kind of, which I would drink, but not a whole lot. Then the thing with the residency happened. I tried the drugs. That became a mess. And that's just kind of the evolution. But then when all that happened and all of those different me's that I had created fell, all that I had left was just this unstructured time. And like, what do I do now? And it just seemed easiest to cope by being a little bit drunk every now and then every day, and then all the time.
And so then what? I mean, what's different from where you're sitting right here today than that one where it was just drink all the time? I mean, what happened between there?
I got really sick. I mean, it was about a several year progression. I moved from the South to Chicago to more or less run away. I didn't really want the help that my family was trying to give me. And
You moved to Chicago.
Yeah.
And so what happened when, I mean, your drinking got out of control for you? I mean, yeah, it was all okay. The time. And yeah. So how do you get to, what happened from there?
So after several kind of lame attempts at recovery, I more or less gave up. I thought, this is really, like, I am one of these people who can't stop drinking and there's really no hope. Look at all I had. Look at what I've done to it. This is it, you know, like, I'm not gonna live. And so I just more or less lived day to day drinking what I could to kind of erase my thoughts. And that turned into physical problems that it got worse and worse. And I wound up in the hospital several years ago because physically my liver had just pretty much stopped working. And it was to the point that I really wasn't communicating much with my family. There was one person in my life who really had taken care of me to that point and pushed me to get into the hospital. And within hours of getting into the hospital, I was in the intensive care unit and they called my parents up from Tennessee and said she may not live any more than 24 hours. So my whole family came up, my mother and father and brother and sister, and I don't remember much about that period of time, but I had basically just a huge medical event that most people thought I was going to die. That
you had liver failure.
Yes, my liver was failing. What I have been told, I don't remember that period of time very well, though, the doctors told my parents that my liver was not really functioning at all. And they didn't know if they could turn it around and that it could go either way.
And so stepping back for a second, talking from a doctor standpoint, tell us about the liver. I mean, why is this, you know, this has been going on for a while. I mean, your liver is a pretty hardy organ. What was going on in your body that you could even see that your liver was not functioning well?
Well, I was insulting my liver in all kinds of ways. I mean, I was drinking daily and almost really not eating at all. But I physically looked like what I can remember in my medical training, an end-stage liver disease individual. I had a swollen belly. It's called ascites. I had a lot of...
With ascites, I mean, it almost looks like a Homer Simpson belly, right? I
yeah.
mean, it's like a big beer belly that's hard and almost to the touch.
Right, yeah. And little spider angiomas, and which are
that?
Like these little blood vessels that are burst that are on your face and on your belly. And I was a little bit yellow, jaundiced, and my eyes were bloodshot.
Any swelling anywhere?
It's completely.
Besides the belly.
I had swelling, just like water weight in my feet and legs, and all of me was swollen. I was about 50 pounds heavier than I actually am with water weight.
And so the idea, if I understand from a clinical social worker perspective, is that your liver wasn't able to literally filter everything through. And so the jaundice was from extra ammonia in your body.
Right.
And then the swelling was because your liver, being a really hardy organ, is what basically is your filtration system in a way. And so it wasn't able to filter things through. And then the fluid built up in your limbs. Is that correct?
Yeah, in your tissues and everywhere. Yeah, it's just not leaving. So.
And so, I mean, you were how old at that point?
35.
And you were at end-stage liver disease, which people with liver disease and way end stage of life are what they're experiencing if they have a liver disease.
Well, when the liver stops, it looks the same at end stage as it does in an acute phase thing. And, you know, obviously sitting before you today, I don't look anything like that. So my liver was very angry for that period of time. But due to the changes that it took me a little while to get the hang of after that horrible event, I have basically regained total, complete health at this point.
And so in that process where your liver was like, lady, I'm out, what did you learn about what was going on with your body at that time? Besides heavy alcohol use, and that was really making your liver angry, as you said.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually, there was a short window of time where when I was getting better from being ill, I was absolutely miserable because I had to stop drinking, and because I was in a lot of physical pain, I couldn't take anything. You know, I was just physically very unwell, mentally very unwell. So a lot of that period of time is foggy to me. My parents were told when I was ill that I had Hep C or was Hep C positive. And
did
then
you know that?
I was not told that, or if I was, I don't remember it. I, though, then went to a specialist that saw me, but because I didn't have insurance at the time, my medical records weren't transferred very well, and he ran the tests again. And so the first time I heard it was from him. He told me, you were Hep C positive, but I need to run some more tests. And so the next time you come back, we'll talk about all that, and we'll talk about treatment or whatever you may need. This was several months after the big sickness that I had when I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks and really couldn't walk for about a month. But I had started to get some better. I wasn't drinking. But that day that he told me I was Hep C positive, I was still just basically a miserable person. Like, my life is ruined physically. You know, who knows what I'm going to regain. When he told me that, I left and I was just like, what's the point? I mean, I was told when I got out of the hospital, never touch another drink. Your liver might go back to exactly where it was. You'll just be in the intensive care unit again. You may die. I bought a beer and I drank it and I didn't get sick from it and I felt a little better. So obviously I reacted to hearing I had Hep C in the only way I knew how to cope at the time, which was to just cover up whatever I was feeling.
And so when you were in the hospital, I mean, they knew that you were struggling with alcohol originally, right? I mean,
So
when you got out, everyone knew it was you were ill, and then they released you, but there wasn't much social support to help you live differently than you were before you were in liver disease. And so here you are, your liver, you didn't die. Thank goodness. But the only thing that's different, really, I mean, is that you're not drinking and there's no other kind of social supports that were put in there for you. And you lasted a month without drinking until you heard about the Hep C diagnosis.
Yeah. It was a little more than that.
A little more than two months.
Yeah.
And that was the first you had heard of it.
Yeah, the first I'd heard of it.
And your parents had known.
I only just more recently have talked with them about that. And what they tell me is that they were told, the doctors told them that I was Hep C positive. And then the doctors came back to them and said something they couldn't really understand, which was that unclear to them whether I had it or not. And they were upset with the doctors at the time. But that was really their only understanding of it.
What were they confused by?
I believe probably because of what I now know about Hep C is that what I learned in this trip back to my doctor, that I have been exposed to the Hep C virus. So I'm Hep C positive, but my body cleared the virus. So I don't have any viral load. So probably that's what the doctors found, that I had been exposed to the Hep C virus. But then the second labs that they found, too, were just that I didn't have any viral load. So that really wasn't playing into necessarily what was happening to me at that moment with in the hospital either.
And so to break that down, with hepatitis C, which is a infectious disease, that's about 60 times more infectious than HIV. Once your body comes in contact with it and it goes into your liver, we develop acute infection. And maybe you did or didn't have signs of acute infection. But what can happen in about, they say, roughly 25 to 33% of people, and they're generally white women, are able to spontaneously clear the virus. Their liver somehow, based on certain genetics, actually can clear the virus so that chronic infection doesn't continue. And so it sounds like that's what happened with you, is that if I were to test you right now for antibodies, you have antibodies because you've been exposed. But your liver actually, amazingly, it was in liver failure, you were about to die, and it regenerated itself and it actually cleared itself of the hepatitis C virus. So you don't have chronic infection. You don't have the virus, but you have antibodies.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So you've had a lot of, challenges in terms of facing challenge and death in the face and hepatitis C virus diagnosis, medical school, almost dying. And wow, I mean, you're sitting here not in that place at all today.
I just tend to think of it as I've dodged a lot of bullets. And in looking at my life, it is absolutely amazing to me that I'm walking around just as this free person I am right now. I don't have to take a drink. I magically am not dead when I really just should be for so many reasons. At the same time, I should be alive for so many reasons. I've had amazing experiences and I've been incredibly educated so that I can ultimately help so many people. And that's so clear to me now that, I guess that it's hard not to look at my life and think, wow, there must be something greater out there than me helping me get around. I mean, it's impossible to look at my life and not think that, I think. And that has really helped propel me through life. I obviously, my addiction to substances was something that nearly took me out and does take people out. And people, some people find a way to rise above that. And for me, it was recognizing that there was a power outside of myself, or powers outside of myself, that I could rely on, but that had been there all along. And really just understanding that and learning how to access it with the help of other people has been the answer for me.
So what have you done now that you, you know, have this new outlook on life? Almost, I mean, you were given a new life. What have you been able to do as a result with such like a positive path ahead of you?
Well, I have pretty much just my MO really is to try to do the next right thing in the moment. And that right has led to me working in the field of substance abuse treatment. And at this point, I am a case manager, a medical case manager at a treatment center with potential to perhaps even re-enter a medical residency. But what it really looks like to me on a daily basis now is that by living the life I have and sharing my love and my experience with others, I've just been able to be a really positive force in terms of relationships with friends and family. And I really just hope to carry that to as many people as I can in life. And, you know, whether that looks like me being a doctor in the future, or it just looks like me fulfilling some role in some organization, you know, I don't know, representing any number of things, because my story covers a lot of different possibilities for future jobs. Like, I don't know, I'm kind of rambling, but right now I feel like I have a sense of purpose that I never really had before. That's kind of where I'm at.
And Linda, give us some sort of insight about the multiple things that you've addressed in terms of the multiple reasons that you were choosing to use, whether it be your sexual identity or always wanting to be perfect and doing well and making your parents proud or being something for others. And the fact is that humans struggle with addiction, drug use. Humans use drugs. History shows that. And we're seeing, you know, acute rates of hepatitis C among youth. We're seeing, obviously, a number of issues going on with addiction, much of which is stemming from the shame or internalized homophobia or lack of support or whatever it might be. Knowing all of that, what kind of message would you give to people who may be struggling with addiction, to youth who are struggling with their own identity, because we all struggle with identity, whether we're gay or we're not, or family members who might have a loved one who's struggling? What, in any of those sort of realms, what reflection might you give to people listening?
Well, very specifically for young people struggling with addiction and using needles, for my own story, I shared needles one time and wound up being exposed to the disease of Hep C.
From one time.
And I know specifically when that was. That was the only time I actually shared. But, I mean, using drugs or alcohol impairs your judgment in so many ways. Whether you're addicted or not, you put yourself at incredible risk for disease. So,
and you knew about them. You were a doctor and you knew about
this.
I
knew, yeah. And I just didn't care. All reason was out the window. And that's really just what happens, though, with addiction. If you are struggling with addiction, it is absolutely not hopeless. There are so many things that you can do for help, but you pretty much have to want it. that was the issue for me. I didn't have hope because I didn't really think I could recover, and I'm not sure I really wanted the help. But when you do, when you're willing to ask for help and willing to listen to others, you can recover.
But it sounds like it's not even a straight path from there, because it sounds like for that month or two when you were almost dead afterwards, you know, you weren't drinking. You almost did or didn't. You were still angry, but you drank again. And so, you know, I think that there is something out there that people may want sobriety. But the fact is that addiction is a disease in itself. And so the desire to want to can be there. But what about the power and the control of addiction itself? So can you talk a little bit about the fact that people might be stuck in an addiction, but still maybe want to get help, but maybe don't know how or can't?
Yeah, well, for me, what it looked like was going to treatment, because I had to figure out some way to keep myself away from drugs or alcohol for a period of time to clear my head. And then my life was transformed, like I said, by the recognition of a higher power that could help me. And I basically have learned how to live life in a way that I don't need substances now, through the help of a 12-step program that has given me a lot of, or basically a guidance for life that I've been able to just use in all parts of my life.
Give me some other synonyms for higher power. There's a number of them.
Yeah, a lot of people would say God, which I can use. There's so much attached to it from the religious background I have, which I'm grateful for, but it doesn't really... I spent a number of years rejecting that and was a staunch atheist, really. So it was hard for me coming into a recovery or a life of recovery and use the word God. So good orderly direction is kind of one way that people... But I tend to think of it as maybe like the energy of the universe, some sort of spiritual connection that we all have. But it's clearly a power outside of us that... there's a lot of unexplainable things out there that happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of miracles. And just accepting those as a part of this unexplainable world, and if you want to call it God, if you higher power, whatever, any of those things. But that's why I'm here today.
And you talk about miracles, and I think that your story reflects that on so many different, in so many different ways, with some really beautiful symbols. I mean, me as a huge hepatitis C advocate, the liver in itself is a beautiful symbol in your story. It is an organ. You are a hardy, resilient woman. And when you look at the human liver, the organ itself, it's a really hardy, resilient organ, which really is a non-complaining organ. And you are a pretty non-complaining person as well. But when you look at hope and resiliency and regeneration, that's just what the sheer essence of your story is, from your liver regenerating itself from being ill to now it being healthy and fully functioning, which our livers can do, to being in a place of being really angry and being able to regenerate. When you said you didn't know what to do with yourself, couldn't drink, and this, to actually creating purpose and creating hope and miracles for other people. And so that's like, do you realize all those things?
Yeah, well, you know, and actually just listening to you say all that, I feel like I haven't given enough credit to the human connections, the love I feel for my family, and how their love gave me hope and to even start the process of thinking, maybe I can survive this mess I've made. Maybe I can come back. Maybe I should. And the human connections that I continue to make and grow are really what's pulling me along. And that's what really I was allowing to leave me. But ultimately, yeah, hope is the number one thing that got the ball rolling for me and has me here where I am today.
And what would you say to someone in terms of hope? Maybe they've lost hope. Or they're wondering, I mean, what the heck is this woman talking about hope? I mean, shoot, I don't got money. I don't got nothing. I don't got family. What am I mean, what can I do with myself if I, is there really hope for me?
There is hope for everyone. I think really reach out to the person next to you and ask for help.
And that wasn't an easy thing for you to do. I mean, you were you are a very independent, smart doctor. I would imagine asking for help, for you asking for help, was probably a big challenge. Is it still?
It completely. It still is. I have learned so much about doing that. But at the core of it, I want to feel responsible or think that I can accomplish whatever I need to get done on my own. But I have found that it is universally more enjoyable, better, easier if I ask for help and join others and help them.
I wish people could see the smile on your face if you talked about that. So maybe you could hear the smile on your face. But would you say that hope, you're a medical case manager, you said.
Yeah.
You're a Ryan White case manager. So you work with patients who are HIV positive and struggling with addiction.
Right.
What do you think they look at you as seeing? I mean, they may or not know your story. They see a young chick, white chick, short hair. You know, what the heck do you know? I'm nothing like you. How can you give me any hope?
Well, I usually listen to them, listen to their story. And most of the time I let them know that I understand where they're sitting because I have sat there as well. And that no matter where they're at, they're now sitting with me. I'm someone who wants to help them. And that it really can happen. That no matter how bad you think things are, in fact, the adversity in your life may be the one thing, the disease even of HIV or Hep C, may be the thing that helps you get a handle on everything and really just see this adversity as something that you can learn from and move through. And the extra help you're going to get from the world because you have these issues is really going to be help, something that'll help you pull yourself out of where you're at. And that has worked well for me so far. I mostly have been able to gain the trust of others when they understand, regardless of how I look to them, that I've been there and that really what they thought was a terminal, terrible, awful thing happening to them could simply be something that could be medically managed and just a part of their life, like that might, you know, just be a part of their story rather than the end of them.
Or they could turn into good.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you have.
Hope to.
Well, just sort of in our last few minutes, the element of help and asking for help. Even though you've done that and you've gotten help, you said it's still hard for you. What are some of the things that you do in your mind or in your daily spiritual practice or energetic practice, whatever it might be, that helps with that, helps you to get help? Because it's not easy. Even if you've been helped and you're like, oh, that was great, that was really helpful, it's not easy to ask somebody else for help or even realize that you need help. What might be some words of wisdom you could share about how you're able to continue to open yourself up, but realize that you need to open yourself up to others' help?
Well, at this point, I don't have drugs or alcohol to cover up sort of like emotional pain or confusion I'm in. So when I'm in it, I pretty much know now that I have to reach out for help in some way. For me, backing up the spiritual side of my life is very important. So that just kind of pausing and then the next right thing in that moment is oftentimes discussing the problem with people close to me. But it's asking for help is kind of a learned thing. But when you're when you live your life on the kind of more spiritual basis that I do now, it's almost just reflexive. Like, I'm sorry that I'm not coming up with any real advice here, but really just trusting that others can be there for you.
And knowing you a little bit and knowing my own human struggle as well and the human condition, part of it, I think, is realizing that emotions are just energy. And that sometimes we're like, oh my God, I'm feeling so much. I got to drink or do something to cover it up. And if we realize that it's just energy, and if we could just hold that energy, maybe it's making our container a little bigger to hold that energy. It won't be so hard. We won't need something to tolerate it or to do something with it. Just
right.
hold it as energy and just realize it as such.
Right. This too shall pass. Like that's the main lesson I've learned, that anything I'm feeling or feel overwhelmed by is simply just sort of between my two ears, and really, like, I'll get through it. But it's so much easier with the help of others.
Any other last things you want to make sure you share?
This has been an amazing experience. Life is totally an adventure now, and I can see it as such. I'm not sure for most of it before I did. It was just like one achievement to the next, and then, you know, watching it fall to the ground. So, I don't know. I'm grateful for this experience, like all of them at this point.
I have one question.
Mm-hmm.
Were there relationships in your life that you've now had the chance to rebuild successfully, or just in general had an opportunity to rebuild?
That's been a part of this whole process of recovery. I know I've talked about my family. Obviously, I distanced myself from them, and now I my relationship and connection with each member of my immediate family is so full and rewarding, and then friends along the way. I'm still in the process of rebuilding that, and nothing really, I feel like nothing is lost, and anything that I don't have access to now, or any people, I've either learned from that experience or been able to look at it as something that has helped me grow and learn. I am eternally grateful for all of the close friends I've had throughout all of this, including the ones that sort of watched me descend and even assisted me sort of in my addiction. But rebuilding relationships has been one of the most freeing things for me that my program of recovery has helped me with.